Welcome to Surprisingly Free from the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. I'm your host, Jerry Brito. Our website is surprisinglyfree.com, where you can subscribe to the show, find other episodes, comment on this podcast, and find links and other information related to today's conversation. Our email address is info@surprisinglyfree.com. We'd love to hear from you. Today is April 17th, 2013, and my guest is Paul J. Heald, professor of law at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. He is the author, with Christopher Boccafusco, of Do Bad Things Happen When Works Enter the Public Domain? Empirical Tests of Copyright Term Extension. We're going to discuss that paper today. Paul, welcome to Surprisingly Free.
Thanks for having me.
So in the paper, you're basically addressing the claim that when copyrighted works lose protection and they fall into the public domain, that they basically bad things happen, that they're mistreated, and so therefore we should keep them under copyright protection for longer periods of time. So do you want to explain to us, maybe to start, what is the public domain and how does it relate to copyright?
Sure. The public domain is basically the reservoir of works which can be freely used by anybody to be rearranged, to be copied, to be used as the basis for new works. And there's basically two sort of occupants of the public domain. The first you can think of is just basically ideas that aren't owned by anyone at all, or stories, fairy tales, folklore, stuff that's existed in our culture and other cultures for a long period of time. The second set of occupants of the public domain are works that used to be copyrighted, but which the copyright term has expired, so that due to expiration of an original copyright, they fall into the public domain and become free for everybody to use. And really keeping an eye on the public domain and nurturing it is important for a couple of reasons. First of all, obviously, it's a cheap reservoir, right? If you don't have to pay a licensing fee to access a myth or a piece of folklore or a book that's fallen out of copyright, if you can copy it for free, prices drop. And it's easier to use something that you don't have to ask permission to use. Second, really follow-on innovation becomes much more possible when people want to do a sequel to a work, for example. It's much easier and cheaper to do that also if one doesn't have to pay a licensing fee to some sort of owner of the underlying work. So there's both a consumer benefit in terms of lower prices and also a benefit to follow-on artists and follow-on creators in that they have fewer transactions to enter into in order to do their own new creative work.
So if the public domain is so wonderful and has all these benefits, why do we have copyright at all? Why don't works just enter the public domain immediately?
Sure. Well, I mean, the theory is that without at least a decently long copyright term, some of these works might not get created in the first place. The argument's really strong, for example, with movies, where you have to invest hundreds of millions of dollars sometimes to make a movie. Nobody's going to make that kind of investment unless they know that there's a period of time where they had the exclusive right to show the movie, where they can recover their sunk costs of an investment. And, you know, the argument's quite a bit weaker when we're talking about what we write in our diary or perhaps the musings of a very self-motivated poet. But the theory is we need at least some period of protection in order to provide incentives for some of these works to be created in the first place.
So that's the justification for having copyright in the first place, is provide an incentive. Now, what your paper is getting at is the extension of copyright terms, not for prospective works that haven't yet been created. By the way, when we say works, I think you and I are going to use the word works a lot here. We mean books, movies, poems, video games, anything of the, you know, anything creative like that can be fixed in a tangible medium.
Exactly.
So it makes sense to have some amount of copyright protection to incentivize folks. And that term, which is set by Congress, Congress might decide, well, we should give them a little bit more. You know, if we make the term a little bit longer, we think we might get some more creation, and that'll be good. But your paper is about something else. Your paper is about a work is already created, it's already protected, and the term it has is extended.
Exactly.
You want to, so what is Congress thinking when it does
Well, it's
that?
always difficult to know exactly what Congress is thinking.
Well,
If you look in the legis yeah, if you look in the
I
legis
guess I was just going to say that basically that the incentive rationale doesn't work. So that can't be what they're thinking, right?
Right, exactly. If you look in the legislative history of the last term extension that occurred in 1998, the main argument offered was that works, if they fall into the public domain, might become less available to consumers if they no longer have owners to sort of be their shepherds and be their advocates and distribute, take responsibility for distribution, that the works would sort of become orphans and they would disappear and be less available to the public. I've shown in a couple of papers exactly the opposite is true, but that was the main bad thing that Congress was worried about if it allowed works to continue to fall into the public domain. So essentially, in 1998, Congress, since 1998, nothing has fallen into the public domain due to expiration of copyright term, and nothing will until 2018. And of course, copyright owners are already lobbying Congress to have another extension in 2018 to make sure nothing more will fall into the public domain again.
So that's interesting. Maybe you can sort of explain that a little bit more deeply. So nothing will begin to fall into the public domain until 2018. You would think that, given a term, which is life of the author plus X number of years, something new would be falling into the public domain every year. But that's not the case.
Yeah, so the current copyright term for new works created in the United States is life of the author plus 70 years. However, for the works that would be falling into the public domain or would have fallen into the public domain from 1998 on, the term for those works is just a straight 75 years. So we don't have any life of the author term for works until after the 1976 Act. So if you look backwards, well, you used to be able to look backwards 75 years and see what was in the public domain. After the 1998 term extension, Congress extended that to 95 years. So basically, right now, the public domain is fixed at the year 1923. So everything before 1923 is in the public domain. Everything after 1923 is potentially copyrighted if the owners filled out the right paperwork. And as I noted, the works from 1923 should have fallen in the public domain in 1990 at the end of a 75-year period, but Congress sort of put this 20-year moratorium. And nothing has fallen into the public domain since.
So in 1998, Congress extended the copyright of existing works for 20 years to 2018, and now we're beginning to see copyright owners lobby for another extension. Okay, so you already talked about one of the rationales given for this extension, which is sort of a public goods argument that unless there's an owner, nobody's going to have an incentive to protect, preserve, commercialize the works until we won't have access to them. There, you point out also in your paper that there sort of is an opposite rationale given by the same folks, which is sort of a tragedy of the commons rationale. You want to
Right.
talk about
So,
that?
yeah. So, although Congress seemed to be mostly worried about the lack of availability and the lack of exploitation of works when they fall into the public domain, economists since have sought to justify what Congress did by speculating that, in fact, when a work falls into the public domain, it might be overused. So it could be overexploited, at least according to some economists, in the same way that common grazing lands in England were overexploited and eroded and destroyed in 18th century England. That problem, of course, was solved by the enclosure movement and the proprietizing of formerly public spaces. It's the same rationale why we don't let everybody who wants to drill in a common pool of oil or gas. So some economists apply that rationale to copyrighted works and suggest that if a work falls in the public domain, so many people will exploit it that we'll become tired of it. It'll get worn out, essentially, and will lose its value. There's a second type of overexploitation that you can find in some of the literature, and that is a suggestion that the work might be used inappropriately. Not that it's overused or used too much, but rather that maybe a single pornographic use or some other sort of inappropriate use would create such a distaste in the public's mouth that the value of the work would also plummet. So there's sort of overuse and misuse as two sort of alternative justifications for term extension.
I have a hard time sort of understanding the overuse argument, given that, you know, these works are non-rival, right? There's not a fixed amount of these, given that we can make as many copies as we want,
right.
We can make as many derivatives as we want. The idea is that we would get played out.
Well, I think the only even convincing hypothetical I've heard, might be a work falling to the public domain, and then it's used sort of in the background of commercials, or used too frequently in movie soundtracks or something like that. So we get sick of it, and you know, we've all heard songs too often on the radio, maybe, or maybe even in commercials. Maybe we've heard them so often that we've gotten sick of them. And I think that's what economists are talking about, overexposure leading to us not wanting to even encounter the work in the future. It's hard to see how that argument would apply to books, because we're never forced to consume books against our will. We're not going to, you know, somehow encounter a book so many times in such a way that we get sick of it. But maybe with music. Now the argument against that, of course, is that music owners seem utterly uninterested in policing the the overuse of their songs. So, in, for example, the standard ASCAP contract, owners of musical compositions have no interest in preventing radio stations from playing a song every single 5 minutes if they want to. You can do that. And we don't hear the same song in commercials all the time either, because it's just bad business practice. You don't want to alienate consumers by using the same song as everybody else does. So there's strong hints in the market that this sort of overuse really doesn't happen, even in the only kind of situation where we might imagine it happening. But, you know, in theory, you can kind of imagine what the economists are talking about.
Yeah. I mean, I guess kind of hinting at your experiment, you can sort of tell that this isn't a problem, because, you know, in all of the popular movies today, we don't hear Camp Town Races being played over and over, even though it's available and is in the public domain. So interesting.
Right.
Okay. So you have three sort of rationales put forth for why, you know, that might justify existing copyright term extension. So a public goods argument, tragedy of the commons argument, and sort of kind of like a tarnishment argument. So you tested these empirically. How did you do that?
Right. So I've done this in a couple of other studies. The most recent study, I'll just take a second to explain it, has to do with the market for audiobooks. So we have a list of best-selling novels from 1913 to 1932. So given that magic 1923 cutoff date, we've got about 200 books from the 10 years before 1923, all of them New York Times bestsellers, all of them in the public domain, and then, you know, another approximately 200 books on the other side of the divide from 23 to 32, all of which are still protected by copyright, all of which still have owners.
So also bestsellers.
We looked at, excuse me?
Also bestsellers on both sides.
Also bestsellers, right? We took them all from the New York Times bestsellers list and one other source of popular books. So we looked at, first of all, how many audiobooks had been made of all of these novels. So we tracked all the novels on Audible.com, which basically is virtually a monopolist with audiobooks. It's very hard to find anybody else who carries any titles that Audible doesn't. So it's nice to sort of have all of your data in one place. So we discovered that about a third of the public domain books had been turned into audiobooks that were available on either audible.com or LibriVox.org. And only, I think it is, 16% of the copyrighted novels had been turned into audiobooks. In other words, the public was doing a better job, the market was doing a better job of making the public domain novels available in digitized audiobook form than the copyright owners were. So it addresses the underexploitation argument, at least in the market for audiobooks of fiction bestsellers. It seems very difficult to argue that when a work falls into the public domain, somehow it becomes less available. It seems very clearly to become more available.
So can we just clarify one thing? So you mentioned
Sure.
Audible.com, which I think most folks are familiar with. It's an audiobook company owned by Amazon, and you can subscribe and you get you can buy audiobooks from them. But you mentioned LibriVox. You want to tell us what LibriVox is and how it works?
Yeah, sure. I'd love to put an ad for them. I'm really cheap. I hate buying my audiobooks, so I discovered LibriVox.org, where amateurs record public domain novels and make them available for free download. So, of course, Audible, even if it's a public domain book, you have to pay for it because it's a professional recording of the public domain book. LibriVox are amateur recordings. They're all available for free, and they're of varying quality, which was part of the stimulus for the second part of this experiment. Just occurred to me when I was listening to a particularly bad LibriVox recording that maybe there might be something to this argument that when a work falls into the public domain, it loses an owner and it loses a particular profit-motivated individual who could supervise the exploitation of the work, and that maybe there was some traction to this notion that if a work fell into the public domain, we'd get bad derivative versions of it, and maybe in fact if we hear a bad audio version of a book, we might be it might lower our own valuation of the original work. Maybe we wouldn't want to read it having heard a lousy audiobook version. So it struck me as a nice sort of existing market to test and see, A, whether public domain audiobooks were of lower quality, and two, whether the lower quality would somehow negatively affect consumers' underlying perception of the value of the written book.
Okay, so the first thing you did, sort of addressing the first question, the public goods sort of argument, you look at the universe of books done both by LibriVox, so they're going to be public domain, and by Audible, which are going to be both public domain and copyrighted books. And what you find is that books, and there are more books in the public domain that have audiobook versions than copyrighted books. Is that right?
And that's true even if we throw out all the amateur LibriVox versions, even if we just look at LibriVox alone, there are still more LibriVox versions of public domain books than of books from the copyrighted set.
So the idea that if a book falls in the public domain, there's not going to be access to it because there's nobody who's going to want to take the time to make it accessible kind of falls by the wayside.
Yeah, at least in this market, and I've
Sure.
shown previously in a couple of other markets that's also true, yeah.
Okay, so let's go forward and talk about the quality argument, the tragedy of the commons sort of argument that you were starting to talk about. Tell us about how you
Right. So
tested
what we,
that.
yeah. So th this is really fun, actually. We took the we didn't have the time or the money to sort of check the quality of every single book in the database.
You'd have to listen to
So
it.
what we did is we took the top 20, the most popular 20 titles from the public domain side, and then the 20, actually the 20 most popular titles from the copyrighted side. First of all, I'll note, not surprisingly, that of the 20 most popular titles from before 1923, they all have audio, professionally read and amateur audiobook versions. We found at the time we did the study, only 16 of the 20 most popular books from 1923 to 32 had audiobook versions. You still, as far as I know, can't get an audiobook version of Mutiny on the Bounty, right? Because it's copyrighted, and the folks who would like to make a audiobook version have been unable, I guess, to convince the copyright owner. So even just sort of breaking out the top 20, we still find that the availability argument doesn't seem, the lack of availability argument doesn't seem to be
It kind of
very strong.
cuts the other way, right?
It
Because,
it it
oh, go
yeah
ahead.
it does, and I've just done a, I mean, I don't want to jump to a different study, but I've done a randomized study of 2,500 fiction titles at Amazon.com, and it's amazing how the public domain dominates. There are, for example, three times as many new books from Amazon published originally in the 1850s than there are books originally published in the 1950s, right? And these are not, you know, used books or books being sold by Amazon affiliates. These are new books in the Amazon warehouse. And for almost every decade in the 1800s, there's more books than in the 20th century because wow. copyright owners, you know, will keep a book available for a couple of years and then it goes on the shelf and never appears again. Wow. Anyway, that's a digression. But what we did for the audiobooks to test their quality was to take the first 5 minutes of the fifth chapter of the 16 most best-selling public domain books and then the 16 best-selling copyrighted books. And like I said, we had to stick with 16 because four of the top 20 in the copyrighted side were missing. We had professional recordings of the first 5 minutes of the fifth chapter of all of these 32 books. And then we also had a single reader do the same reading for all of the books, just so that we could control for possible quality differences between the texts. So we were able to show by having a single voice read those first 5 minutes of the fifth chapter of all the books that, in fact, there wasn't any other variable that seemed to be influencing their opinion of quality. He got virtually the same score reading the public domain books as the copyrighted books, in other words. So we knew that the readings themselves were equally attractive. Now let's look and see what's actually on the market and see what the response consumers have to different readers is. And just in short, consumers listen to the 5 minutes and then rate the reader. We actually sort of tricked the listeners briefly into thinking that they were helping us, helping a professional audiobook company hire new readers. So they were ranking the readers in terms of how good they were and whether they were ready to do professional audiobook readings or not. And they rated the readers on a 1 to 6 Likert scale. And what we found actually was that the readers of the public domain audiobooks were rated slightly higher than the readers of the protected audiobooks, although it's not a statistically significant difference. So again, kind of hard to say that when a book falls into the public domain and you look for it on Audible, you're going to get a lousier recording than if you're looking for a copyrighted book. I'll note, not surprisingly, that if you just look at the LibriVox readers, they don't do as well. They do statistically significantly worse, and that's not surprising. Sometimes they do great, sometimes they do bad. There's really no quality control on that website.
So just to be clear, there's a 2x2 grid here, which I think this might be confusing to somebody just trying to picture this in their head. You've got, on one side, you've got books that are in copyright and books that are out of copyright, and then all of those books are read by both, or no, I guess not all of those books, but you have readers that are LibriVox and then professional Audible.com readers.
Right.
And
yeah, and we shouldn't say, and they're, yeah, we should, they're professional. Audible, of course, doesn't hire people to do readings. So these are professional readers from a wide variety of audiobook companies, all of whom sell on Audible.
Okay. And so the out-of-copyright books did better?
The out of copyright books did better, yes. On if we're just looking at what you can get on Audible, they did better, yeah.
And so what does that tell us?
Well, it tells us that a work doesn't have to have an owner in order for the market to produce a good quality derivative work. And this is all really sensible. I'm a University of Chicago grad. I love markets. And why would you, if you're an audiobook company recording audiobooks, why would you hire a lousy reader? You want to make money. So whether you're choosing a copyrighted book to sell or to record and sell, or a public domain book to record and sell, you're going to want to have a good reader. You're going to want to make a profit, and that profit motive is enough, and there's enough discipline in the market itself to make sure that, to demonstrate that, you know, just because a public domain piece of fiction lacks an owner doesn't mean that nobody cares about the quality of the work.
Well, but so but let's talk about the tragedy of the commons sort of argument. you can imagine that. Sure, you probably have an incentive to hire the best reader because you want to make money, but would you even get into the business of doing this? Because, if it's in a public domain, there's no stopping how many people can come out and compete with you, and you can't, control for their quality, and so this kind of gets to the tarnishment argument a little bit. And you can imagine that you can go to Amazon.com, search for the book you're looking for, and you're going to have like a dozen different versions of varying quality. You're going to get lost in that shuffle. The prices are always going to be lower because of all that competition. And so nobody's going to do it.
Right. So, I mean, but we can sort of understand the theory, right? I mean, why make an audiobook version of Treasure Island? I mean, anybody can do it. You're going to face significantly more competition than if you're doing an audiobook version of The Great Gatsby with the permission of the F. Scott Fitzgerald estate. You're going to be the only person selling the book. You'll be able to charge a higher price. It's got plenty of incentives. Why do a version of David Copperfield or Treasure Island? Well, there's still money to be made there, and if you think about it, that's the sort of normal market that surrounds us all the time. Why sell milk? Anybody can sell milk. Why sell paper clips or rubber bands or string or aluminum foil? You're not going to have any sort of monopoly power there. You're going to face incredible competition that drives the price down. But nonetheless, we have really efficient and attractive markets for milk and paper clips and aluminum foil. So, that's our normal American way of thinking about markets and the sort of incentives that we find there. It's a very, very rare situation where we think the government somehow has to give you a piece of paper that makes you a monopolist in order to make sure that a work is either adequately available or doesn't fall victim to a tragedy of the commons.
I agree with you, and what's so amazing to me, which I think is part of the other study you were talking about, is those four books that were not available as audiobooks. Because all the books you're talking about are bestsellers, but of course, most books aren't going to be bestsellers, but yet are still going to be very valuable. I know that in my line of work, I will often search for books that are, a little bit specialized, maybe from 10 years ago, and I go on Amazon and I search for them, and they're not available as ebooks. And you know what? They're probably never going to be until the day that they're in the public domain. And there's just not going to be much of an incentive for the publisher to do that. But you can imagine that if they were in a public domain, others might sort of come forward to provide that.
Sure. I think that's exactly right. And if you look at, you mentioned what's presently, available in print. If you look at the entire 200 public domain books and the entire 200 or so copyrighted books, I think it was 99, it was 98 or 99% of those public domain books are currently available in print. And it was only, I think, 75, 76% of the copyrighted works were. And we're talking about New York Times bestsellers, right? So 25% of New York Times bestsellers you can't are no longer in print. So you can imagine what your technical books or your less popular works do in that environment.
It's amazing. So as 2018 approaches, I think we all suspect that we're going to see a call for a further extension. Although recently we've seen the Registrar of Copyright sort of propose that in fact maybe that the copyright term should be retracted. What do you think is going to happen?
Well, I think you're going to see the usual suspects proposing another set of term extension. Be a little bit harder this time because there wasn't any empirical work done in 1998 at all. So it was all just theorists opining at each other. Whether Congress will pay attention to the empirical work that's been done in here and in Europe, I don't know. I've kind of proposed, I haven't proposed this in writing, but since the major proponent of term extension, of course, is Disney, and they're tremendously powerful and effective lobbyists, I'd be totally in favor of perpetual copyright for Mickey Mouse. And just give Disney that, and make them and their lobbying power go away. And I think reason would finally prevail in that context, and we'd see an end to these extensions.
If it was only so easy. Something else that's very different about night from about today than it was in 1998 is that today, I think, for number one, we have the internet, which of course existed in 98, but it wasn't as pervasive. You didn't have the social networks you have today. And it seems that the public has grown a little bit weary about some of the excesses of copyright and is paying attention.
I hope that's true. I think also Google, the Google Books project shows that Google cares deeply about an expanding public domain, and just having a single lobbyist on the other side of that size and that power may also help convince Congress to finally let works start falling to the public domain once again.
And of course, Mickey Mouse, even if he were to fall into the public domain, it's not as if Disney isn't left without any recourse for continuing to commercialize the character.
No, that's absolutely right. I mean, what could you do if Mickey Mouse falls in the public domain? What we would be able to do is make copies of movies with Mickey Mouse in them that have fallen in the public domain. So it'd start with 1923. There's really, I don't think there's anything. But eventually you'd get into the 30s, and Disney movies would start to fall into the public domain, and those could then be copied and distributed by other parties. But you're right to suggest a trademark law, would still prevent anybody from selling Mickey Mouse dolls, Mickey Mouse merchandise, Mickey Mouse T-shirts, opening up a Mickey Mouse theme park. Copyright isn't needed in order to prevent all these sort of promotional and highly lucrative exploitations of Mickey Mouse that makes Disney so much money.
And any new Mickey Mouse movies or books that they publish would have their own copyright.
Exactly right. They want it right. Exactly. Disney wants to make further adventures of Mickey Mouse. It's going to be life of actually, since it's a collective work, it'd be 95 years. Whatever. They would
Right, right,
have
right.
instant and long-lasting protection.
Well, here's hoping Congress pays attention to some of the empirical work.
Well, that'd be nice, but we'll see.
We'll see. Well, my guest today has been Paul J. Heald of the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Paul, thanks for being on Surprisingly Free.
It was my pleasure. I really enjoyed it.
This has been Surprisingly Free from the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. For more information, go to surprisinglyfree.com, where you can also comment on today's podcast and find links and readings related to today's conversation. This show was produced with the help of Kat Murthy and Charles Blatz. I'm your host, Jerry Brito. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.